My name is Peter Nash. I teach Old Testament and Hebrew at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. Most of you have heard that several times, but I know some of you are new this morning, so you have to go through that every day for the tape. We've been looking at 1 Samuel, and quick recap, we've discussed the fact that there's some ambivalence in the text as we move from the period in which Yahweh, the God of Israel, is perceived as the king of the nation to the point where the people want to be like their neighbors and have a king of their own to go out before them in battle, to administer justice in the land, to centralize things. And the text itself is ambivalent about that, and I don't think it's clearer at any point than it is in the life of Saul. Some people have described Saul as a tragic figure in the classical sense, that he really does nothing wrong, maybe overstretches his lot in life slightly, but none of his actions are really despicable, and yet he is regarded as the absolute failure of a king who is rejected by God, even to the point that, and as we'll see in 17, the Spirit of God left him, and an evil spirit from the Lord came into him. And that's the problematic piece that I hope we'll get to today. It's a long way there from where I left off yesterday. Good morning. So, what we've been doing is pretty much reading through the text together. We're going to zip through 9 and 10 so we can see what happens with Saul. We joked a little bit about Saul being the man that we would put on the head of the ticket today for election year. He's a tall, good-looking man from a wealthy family. Sort of like Jack Kennedy, George Bush, Al Gore. So we get his pedigree at the beginning of chapter 9. There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorah, son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth. He had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel who was more handsome than he. He stood head and shoulders above everyone else. So there we go, from right to the top of the ticket. One other interesting piece is that in the Sumerian king list, this is a king list from about 2500 BC, and I'm going to adorn my maps, that this is Jerusalem right here, and this is Assyria, or Ashur, and this is Babylon. Sumer, the ancient third millennium nation, is down here just before you get to the Persian Gulf. They had a list talking about when kingship descended from heaven. And ironically, the city of which this kingship descended was a city named Kish. And I've always thought that was interesting. I've never read in any of the commentaries that anyone else thought it was interesting. But kingship comes down from heaven in Israel through the line of a man named Kish, a Benjaminite. And then the oldest story that we have about the kingship being a gift from the gods to humanity, it comes down in Sumer, in a place called Kish. It may only be a coincidence, but I think it's interesting. The Kish sends his son Saul out with one of his servants to look for the donkeys, and they're gone a few days, and had not found them, and they're ready to turn back. And they've been all over the tribe of the land of Benjamin, which, as we talked about before we started, was a fairly small area, and they sort of wandered into slightly foreign territory, like going from Michigan to Ohio in the last week of the college football season. Usually it's okay, but sometimes it's not safe. When they came to the land of Zuf, Saul said to the boy who was with him, again, this boy is properly translated, but it's like boy used to be, and still is in some parts of the United States, a term of someone who is subservient. It means his servant in this case. Let us turn back, or my father will stop worrying about the donkeys and start to worry about us. Which, note that phrase, because it's going to come up later in the story. And the young man, which is often the case in the Hebrew text, we've got this leader someone that we know to be significant, and then they get this word from a servant who remains unnamed throughout the story that gives a significant piece of information. And this significant piece of information is that there's a seer in this region. He's always right. Let's go ask him. Saul's response is, but we have nothing to give him. And then there's a little explanation inserted in the story. In those days, you never went to seek an oracle without bringing a present. It's more of this sacrificial offering, supporting of the priesthood, the prophecy, the bands of prophets. And I, only partially joking the other day, said that it's still reflected in our host or hostess gifts today. Show up somewhere. If we're polite, we show up with a gift, because that's the person who's going to offer us hospitality and protection. So Saul said to the boy in verse 10, good, come, let's go. So they went to the town where the man of God was. We've also seen this phrase, man of God. In chapter 2, this guy just shows up out of nowhere, curses the line of Eli from the mouth of God, and disappears. And now in this case, we've got this man of God, again, out of nowhere. We don't know who he is. We'll find out in just a moment that it's Samuel about whom we've been talking for several days. As they went up the hill to the town, they met some girls coming to draw water, and said to them, is the seer here? And they answered, yes, there he is, just ahead of you. Hurry, he has come just now to the town, because the people have a sacrifice today at the shrine. And it's like a priest or a prophet, isn't it? Just show up when there's a party going on. As soon as you enter the town, you'll find him before he goes up to the shrine to eat, for the people will not eat until he comes, since he must bless the sacrifice. And note that, that becomes important in Saul's downfall in a few chapters. Now go up, you will meet him immediately. So they went up to the town. As they were entering the town, they saw Samuel coming out toward them on his way to the shrine. So now his name is Samuel. He ceases to be this mysterious character. We know now that he is the one who was called from birth, called in a vision in the middle of the night, and predicted to be, has been the leader of Israel proper for several years. Would someone pick up and read from 15 to 21?
The day before Saul came, Yahweh had already disclosed this to Samuel. Tomorrow, about this time, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to rule over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have seen the affliction of my people, and their cry has come to me. So when Samuel saw Saul, Yahweh told him, here is the man I spoke to you about. He shall rule over my people. Saul approached Samuel in the gateway and said, tell me, where is the house of the seer? Samuel answered Saul, I am the seer. Go up ahead of me to the high place, for today you shall eat with me. In the morning before you leave, I will tell you all that is in your heart. As for your asses that were lost 3 days ago, do not worry about them, for they've been found. Samuel added, for whom is the land of Israel? Isn't it for you and for all your father's kin? Saul answered, I am a Benjamite from the least of the tribes of Israel, and my family is the lowliest of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Why do you speak to me in this way?
Okay. Listen to this response from Gideon in Judges 6, verse 14. After God has appeared directly to him, and he's already demurred once from this call to judgment. The Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. I hereby commission you. He responded, but sir, the sir and Lord, both in Hebrew and in Greek, are the same, come from the, translated from the same word. How can I deliver Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the weakest in my family. And Manasseh is a half-tribe. This seems to be sort of a standard, polite response. Right? So if you go to meet the queen, and you say, oh, I'm delighted to meet you, and she says, oh, no, the pleasure is all mine. it seems to be a formal piece of not accepting this sort of responsibility right off the bat. Maybe genuine fear. With Gideon, it's rather funny, a series of tests. Or a series of proofs from God. And we'll see with Saul, there's a series of proofs afterwards. Difference is Gideon asked for them, Saul doesn't. And the next section, they go up to the feast. Samuel invites Saul into this sacrificial feast, places him in a seat of honor, gives him the best portion of the meal, which he has previously reserved for someone whom he knows will be showing up because he's received this word from God. And so you see in 24, in the middle there, eat for it is set before you at the appointed time so that you might eat with the guest. Saul ate with Samuel that day and they came down from the shrine into the town. A bed was spread for Saul on the roof. Remember that these are flat-roofed stone buildings usually, the roof is often the guest chamber, but certainly the sleeping chamber because it's more comfortable than being inside, often with the animals. Then at the break of dawn, Samuel called to Saul upon the roof, get down so that I may send you on your way. Saul got up, both he and Samuel went out into the street, and as they were going to the outskirts of the town, Samuel said to Saul, tell the boy to go ahead. And when he got on, they stopped, and he's going to tell him now the actual word of God. And I see this, since he's about to tell him that he is the king of Israel, as parallel to the stories in the Gospels where Jesus tells the disciples, once they've figured out who he is, not to tell anyone. In the New Testament, we talk about the messianic secret. Here, it's a literal messianic secret because what is about to happen is Saul is about to get mashacht, which is anointed, smeared with oil. And that's what happens to a king or a priest as they're commissioned for their leadership. It's the word that Messiah, Mashiach, is the passive participle from which Messiah comes, and Christos is the Greek translation of Messiah. Clear as mud?
Yeah.
Right, I need to go over this again.
What's Messiah? Is somebody who has oil smeared all over him.
The Messiah literally is someone who has oil smeared all over him. In Greek, it's Christos, from which Christ comes. In Hebrew, the passive participle is Mashiach. And so Christ is just a translation of this term. And what's going to happen at the beginning of verse 10 is after we've separated as a secret anointing, a secret ceremony for Saul at this point, to anoint him, to empower him to be the king of Israel. And it's this Mashach. Which is, the verb means literally to smear oil on something. And it happens almost, I think in the Hebrew Bible, it only happens to kings and priests. Which is a connection that you need to make, I think you need to make when you read the Saul story to realize how badly he's treated by the text. Samuel took a vial, I'm going to read from 10:1. Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him. He said, "The Lord has anointed you ruler over the people of Israel. You shall rule, you shall reign over the people of the Lord, and you shall save them from the hand of their enemies all around." Now this is the king's job, right? Why did Israel insist on a king? Someone in beginning of chapter 9, someone to go before us, or at the end of chapter 8, someone to go before us in battle and protect us from our enemies, someone to administer justice. But primarily here, we're making this transition from the judges. Remember that the judges are primarily political and military leaders rather than juridical leaders, even though we continue to call them judges. That's what Samuel was. He was a little heavy on the religious side. We don't hear any stories about Samuel, many stories about Samuel in times of warfare, but he's still called a judge. And Saul picks up on the military side, which for those of you who saw the split that I made yesterday between religious and moral leadership and political and military leadership, Saul falls mostly on the political military side. In verse 2, "When you depart from me today, you will meet two men." These are the series of proofs that come to, that Samuel offers to Saul unrequested. "You'll meet two men at Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. They will say to you, 'The donkeys that you went to seek are found, and now your father has stopped worrying about them and is worrying about you.'" Well, where have we heard that before?
From the boy, remember, sir.
Well, it was from Saul, wasn't it? Wasn't it that Saul had said it?
Oh, yeah.
This guy begins to sound sort of prophetic. I mean, this is a good choice. This is the kind of person that we want in this leadership role. That's not enough. "Then you should go on further and come to the Oak of Tabor." We see this in the Abraham story, the Oak of Tabor. "Three men going up to God at Beth-El. We'll meet you, one carrying three kids, another carrying three loaves of bread, another carrying a skin of wine. They will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, and you shall accept them from them. After that, you should come to Gibeath Elohim." What does that mean? Something of God. Let's see if I can dredge it up in a minute. "At the place where the Philistine garrison is, there you will come to the town. You will meet a band of prophets coming down from the shrine with harp, tambourine, flute, lyre playing in front of them, and they will be in a prophetic frenzy." You think the prophetic people are crazy these days? Well, they're supposed to be. "Then the Spirit of the Lord will possess you, and you will be in a prophetic frenzy along with them and be turned into a different person. Now, when these signs meet you, do whatever you see fit to do, for God is with you. And you shall go to Gilgal ahead of me, and then I will come down to present burnt offerings and offer sacrifices of well-being. 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what to do." So, a hint that at the beginning of this series of proofs that Saul is actually a prophetic character. And then the third sign is an actual statement that he will become a prophetic character. He's going to meet this band of prophets and he's going to fall in with them. He will fall into the same kind of frenzy and prophesy among them. And this clear statement that God is with him, which, as I read the Hebrew Bible, is something that I'm not sure that I want. In the Joseph story, every time he ends up in prison or in servitude, there's a refrain that Yahweh was with him. When we read that story in Hebrew class, I always quip that if this is what it means to have Yahweh with you, I'm not sure that's what I want. And in there are other places where it actually turns out well for people. But in Saul's case, it becomes rather disastrous. As he turned away to leave Samuel, God returned his heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day when they were going from there to Gibeah. A band of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God possessed him, and he fell into the prophetic frenzy along with them. And then comes this proverb of Saul, also among the prophets, in verse 12. When the prophetic frenzy had ended, he went home. And so we've got him set up. Any questions or comments? I'm going over this rather quickly, so yes.
Why did they say that became a proverb?
Apparently, it becomes a piece that people say. We only have it here once, but apparently it became popular in the land. Probably especially later on when he's in direct conflict with David.
When he says how he comes from the smallest tribe, and you were mentioning how that seemed to be a thing to say, could it be also that God tends to choose leaders from the weak? He'd choose one from a manger, so I don't know, just that's what struck me.
Yeah, you could say that, and you certainly could say that in the David story, but the beginning of chapter 9 makes it quite clear that this is, you know, we get a genealogy. We get lots of genealogies, but we set this guy up as, and his father is a wealthy man. And one thing that we didn't focus on as we read through the story, this gift, he's got a half a shekel of silver. The servant has a half a shekel of silver. Apparently, the father had given him, you know, maybe gave it to the servant so the son wouldn't squander it. I don't know. But the servant is carrying a half shekel of silver, which is not a tremendous amount of money, but it's not a piddling amount either. It's suitable for an offering when you go to make an oracle, request an oracle. So Saul doesn't quite fit that category. He's got this genealogy. He's got, it's noted that he's wealthy. He's tall and good looking, and he's out searching for donkeys, which is another sign of wealth. Another story follows where Saul is again chosen, this time by lot, but you get the feeling that it's sort of rigged, at least by God, which is what Lot is supposed to be anyway, is finding God's chosen. But the point is that there are at least two stories of how Saul is called to be the king of Israel. You said, those of you who were here at the beginning of the week heard me suggest that there was a third story, and that's the birth story of Samuel. Here we get very clearly, still in the text, and somewhat apparently, let me see if I can hatch just a little more, somewhat apparently original form, two stories of Saul's being called or appointed king. With Saul becoming king, evidence of the transitional nature, even from Samuel and continuing in Saul, is the constant connection with the book of Judges. We've seen one with this call from Gideon and the call from Saul. You can juxtapose those. Another piece of the end of Judges is a story that I mentioned a couple of days ago, and that is the rape of the Levite's concubine, when this woman is raped to death, and her beloved slices her up into 12 pieces and sends her out to, I didn't write it, I just tell it. sends her out to rally the forces. And then they go out and they almost destroy the tribe of Benjamin. Now here, apparently the tribe of Benjamin remembers this, because when Saul's first act of military leadership, he hears about this piece of trouble, and in 11 verse 5, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen. Saul said, "What is the matter? The people are weeping." So they told him the message from the inhabitants of Jabesh, and the Spirit of God came upon Saul in power. When he heard these things, and his anger was greatly kindled. He took the yoke of the oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent them throughout the territory of Israel, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." So, again, this time an ox, thank God, is sliced up, and pieces are sent out as a warning to the people that they have to participate as part of the still somewhat tribal confederacy. We're not even, most people don't know that Saul is king yet. And this piece of leadership harkens back to Judges 19.
Is there any conjecture as to why this is done in secrecy to anoint Saul?
No, and we're going to see the same thing happen with David. And what I tried to make a connection with is the same thing happens with Jesus. When the disciples discover that he, or say that he's Messiah, he says, don't tell anyone. I think it has to do with the proper time, as they say in the New Testament, the kairos, the fullness of time, the appropriate time. Even though it's odd here, we're already four chapters after they've asked for a king. The king has been delivered, but we're not telling anyone yet. And in just another chapter, the king's going to be replaced. But no one's going to know that the king has been replaced, because the David-Samuel piece is kept secret. Maybe that's just the way it has to be. You know, we should ask Casper Weinberger and George Bush. Holly North, I don't know. And there's some explanation of that. There's an actual challenge of Saul. Shall Saul rule over us in chapter at the the end of chapter 11, and in 12, Samuel then begins to come clean with them, and Saul is set up as the king in chapter 12. And in 13, we start off with Saul fairly well established, and apparently people weren't sure about this. No one can read this Hebrew text. The Greek text isn't clear. My note here says the number is lacking in the Hebrew text, and the whole verse is lacking in the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation. So we don't know how old Saul was. We don't know how long when he began to reign, and we don't know how long he ruled, but we've got him established as king now at the beginning of chapter 13. And he's about to go out to war, and he's got he's mustering his troops, and the Philistines have mustered their troops, and it's time to go. And people are starting to scatter when they see how many troops the Philistines have. It seems like another one of these insurmountable, overwhelming odds, like Gideon with the Midianites. If you remember, that story, Gideon kept sending troops away until he got down to just the right ones, the ones handpicked by God.
Was Goliath a Philistine?
Yes.
Well, maybe there were a lot of giants in that army too.
It could be, but if you just, just the numbers are enough. Uh-huh. Saul chose 3,000 out of Israel, 2,000 were with Saul, so 2,000 that he knew already at Michmash, in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan and Gibeah, the rest of the people. And then far the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, the troops like sand on the seashore in a multitude. All right, so it's pretty short odds here, or long odds, which is it? Who's been to Las Vegas? You don't want long odds, right? The long odds here for the Israelites. I think, again, we're looking back to the judges, especially to Gideon, with the Midianites. There's no way we should win this war. But he's going to do the proper thing. And verse 8, he waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal. The people began to slip away from Saul. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering here to me and the offerings of well-being. Now we heard this earlier. This is what Samuel's going to come and do in 7 days. Now it's 7 days later, and the people are starting to get really nervous, and they're starting to notice how many Philistines are out there. And I know what I would do if I were an army of 3,000 and going up against 30,000 chariots, which should mean about 90,000 men and 6,000 horsemen. So almost 100,000. Of course, these numbers, I think, are inflated, but they're long odds. So Samuel does the kingly slash priestly thing. This is what a king does when a king's about to go to war. Makes an offering. And it seems like the right thing to do. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, Samuel arrived. And Saul went out to meet him and salute him. Right? He doesn't know he's done anything wrong. This is what a king is supposed to do. A king, priest, or rather merged in the ancient world, if you remember your classical stuff, when you read the Odyssey and the Iliad, the Aeneid. This is, you know, the leaders made the sacrifice, the military leaders made the sacrifices. Sometimes they would go to oracles, but they would still continuously make sacrifices. Same is true in the ancient Near East. Kings would make sacrifices. And so Saul seems to be doing just what we'd expect him to do. And he even goes out to say, oh, I'm so glad you're here. But what does he get met with? What have you done? Saul replied, when I saw that the people were slipping away from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines were mustering at Michmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down upon me at Gilgal, and I have not entreated the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. In the circumstances, I had no other choice. I didn't want to go into battle not having made a sacrifice, not having asked for God's favor. So I forced myself. I didn't want to do it, but you weren't here. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. The Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom will not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. The Lord has appointed him to be ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. So this is the first rejection of Saul.
Where did he do wrong? What should have Saul have done?
He should have continued to wait. According to Samuel, he should have continued to wait. Until Samuel was almost there. It almost looks like, as someone said in the earlier Bible study, and people have said in class before, that Samuel's waiting behind a rock. Just
set him up.
Yeah. I know he's, this isn't the right guy. Somehow we made a mistake. God and me, we made a mistake, and this isn't the right guy. And David's waiting in the wings, and we'll just wait and let him.
But he waited the 7 days, though.
He waited the 7 days, yeah. According to ancient custom, according to what he was told, what we know in the text, this is exactly what he's supposed to do. And that's why literature today, the academic literature at least, treats Saul as a tragic figure, tragic hero, like Oedipus, rather than the evil figure that he's often portrayed in Sunday school. what seems to have happened is that we couldn't have two good kings. There had to be an explanation as to why this guy who was doing anything right was superseded by this other guy. And the only way to make David big was to make Saul small, and he got maligned in the literature. And of course, we've never seen that anywhere.
But are we to infer from this that God makes mistakes?
I wouldn't suggest that. The old rabbinic custom is a guideline is that you never make an interpretation that puts the onus on God. But we're going to see a little further that, as we saw in the, we've seen in the Noah story, that God repents. God is sorry for what God has done. In the Noah story, God repented that he had made humanity and decided to flood us out. And in this story, God was sorry that he made Saul king. We'll skip over 14. And and jump into 15, which in my, and it's in the new RSV, he's actually annotated, it's noted, it's headed as another story of Saul's rejection. You know, this rejection business is tough, but especially if it's God who's doing the rejection business. It seems at this point, as you read this, someone read the first three verses. Chapter 15. Yeah.
Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish the Amalekites for what they did in opposing the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both men and women, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey."
Samuel seems to be a very angry guy.
Yes.
This is a strange piece. It also kind of flashes us back not only to the Judges period, but the period of Joshua. We're jumping back a couple hundred years now to repay the Amalekites for opposing the Israelites when they tried to come into the land. You know, so we've gone through Joshua, through all 12 judges, through most of Samuel's reign, and now we're gonna hop back and punish the Amalekites for this opposition of Israel coming into the land which God promised. And we see this typical piece of holy war imagery, which is called the ban, or haram, which is to go in and destroy everything, kill all, not only the soldiers, all the women, all the children, all the cattle, and in some cases salt, like in Jericho, salt over the field so that nothing can grow there. It's just to make it barren, to preserve the religious purity of the people who are conquerors. What typically happened, what you usually went to war for in the ancient world was for a chance to loot and maybe get another wife or at least some comfort on your journey. But that was, you know, it continues to be the most frightening thing, I think, for women about warfare when it's in their own country, is that soldiers continue to rape as they go through. So this is pretty standard operating procedure for Israelite and for Semitic warriors in general. And we only tend to talk about it today with the Muslims because it's still part of their official theology, but it stands in the text. This is the way you fight a war, especially if it's one that, this is the way you fight a war that God has declared, and that's the only kind that Israel should be fighting, when the God has declared. So you wipe out everything. Questions or comments about that? Well, we know it's, well, the other piece of this is, what does this sound like? With the first verse, when Samuel comes to Saul, and says, "You're anointed, God had me anoint you king to lead the people." It seems that he's completely unaware of what's gone on a couple chapters earlier. He's already chastised him and told him he's been rejected, and now he comes back to him two chapters later. It seems that there are several stories about Saul and Samuel that get pieced together here in a way for our narrative mind isn't coherent, because Samuel seems, it's like that chapter 13 never happened here. And it's why it's headed here as another story of Saul's rejection. So Saul goes out with people, fights the Amalekites, avenges this, 150, 200-year-old blood feud or slight, and doesn't kill the king, doesn't kill all the cattle, and he's on his way back in. And the word of the Lord came in verse 10. If someone would read 10 through 16.
And the word of the Lord came to Samuel, "I repent that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments." And Samuel was angry, and he cried to the Lord all night. And Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, and it was told Samuel, "Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself and turned and passed on and went down to Gilgal." And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed be to the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." And Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep of the oxen and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stop, I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night." And he said to him, "Say on."
Someone pick up 17 through 21.
And Samuel said, "Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. And the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal."
Okay. What follows is a fairly typical prophetic poem about sacrifices not as important as obedience. Which is followed by repentance on the part of Saul. People have asked me why David is the ideal king, and I say, well, it seems that he repents when he finds out he's wrong. And then I reread this, and I'm reminded that Saul did too. And what more can we ask of Saul at this point? Yes.
The question I have is there something in what Israel is doing that Saul represents? Because it seems like it really is a strong message and kind of a confusing one as far as why he will not be, you're alluding to this, that does he represent something that Israel, that God is trying to teach Israel as far as what they need to avoid?
This section that we just read, when Samuel confronts him, he says, "They did it, the people did it," and twice, "They took the best, I fulfilled my mission." about when we were bringing it back for a sacrifice, I think this is a problem of transitional times. You've got the old system that has been working, and people they've already asked for a king, but they're still working, which is a new system, but they're working under the old system. And it's the question is the king going to be under the prophet's leadership, or is the prophet going to be under the king's leadership? And this, when it was Moses and Joshua and the judges and Samuel, it was always the same person. But now we've got these two struggling for leadership. And Saul sort of, the indication in 17 is that Saul sort of sees himself as still just a judge. One of the people elected for a certain time for military leadership, with no separate identity from the role that he plays as king. You may be little in your own eyes, but are you not the leader of the tribes of Israel? If it was just Saul, son of Kish, the Benjaminite, leading for a while, this might have been okay. But now we've got to be reminded of our absolute obedience to Yahweh, and you haven't managed to pull it off. The people haven't managed to pull it off because they're still living in sort of a judgeship mentality. There's also ambivalence in the text as to whether or not kingship is a good idea. It's asking God to step aside and appoint God as a successor. God has done that, and that's problematic. But this text was written during the period of the monarchy. So you can't be too harsh on the monarchy. It was written during the period of the Davidic descendants. So you can't be too deferential to the person whom David deposed. I think all of that plays together in a sort of an interesting weave of why this ambivalence is here, and why Saul gets apparently treated so shabbily. And then finally, just one other piece here in 16. We always talk about, we're frequently taught in Sunday schools and so on, and it's often a criticism of Israel's neighbors that they practice human sacrifice, especially the sacrifice of their children. But here we have Samuel, this wonderful prophet, tremendous leader, called from birth, called as a child, with a direct vision from God. At the end of the chapter, verse 32 and following, then Samuel said, "Bring Agag, king of the Amalekites, here to me, and surely," and Agag said, "Surely this is the bitterness of death." But Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so your mother shall be childless among women." And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord at Gilgal.
And
Samuel,
what?
33. So to hew someone to pieces or hew something to pieces before the Lord, I understand to be a type of sacrifice. Maybe it's only with God as witness. But the Samuel guy, I want to watch out for. And finally, it's 16, the first part of the chapter, we have David anointed in secret. And then David's entrance into Saul's court as the first music therapist in history. We'll skip over the anointing since we're focusing on Saul. And if you look at verse 14, this is the troublesome piece. Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. This is what happens. The Spirit of the Lord comes to the judge to empower him or her to lead the people to victory or salvation, to free them from the bondage of their neighbors. And Saul's servant said to him, and an evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. And Saul's servant said, "See now, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Let our Lord," lowercase, "now command the servants who attend you to look for someone who is skillful at playing the lyre." I wonder if that's a pun in English. "And when the evil spirit from God is upon, when the Spirit of God is upon you, he will play it and you will feel better. And he says, so let it happen. And David, of course, is the musician who comes in. And this is part of the reason that so many of the Psalms are attributed to King David. But in one moment, Saul is the anointed, the chosen, the one upon whom the Spirit of God rests. And the next moment, an evil spirit from God is tormenting him. And this is problematic for me. There are a couple of other places where we see evil spirits or bad spirits from God coming in to people, and I just don't know what to do with it. It may not be anything more in this case than a way of saying Saul was troubled that he was no longer had confidence in himself as the anointed of God, and it was driving him nuts. I mean, it was gnawing away at him. But as we read through the story where he pins David to the wall, his shirt, his tunic to the wall with his spear, and you know, pursues David, as he realizes David is the one who will replace him, it seems more than simple disturbance and jealousy, but he actually seems to go mad. And the text tells us that this comes from God. Now, back to your question, do we say that God made a mistake? I think all that we can say is that God is God. And if we always interpret good things as from God and bad things as not from God, then we have a problem. But if we understand that this is the world that we live in and good things come to us by grace and bad things come to us because that's the way the world is, then this is not quite such a problem. It's still not fun. But it's not quite the problem it is if we have opposing deities, as we often do.
Well, this God is kind of a hard one to be very fond of, what he does.
Yeah.
Assuming that Samuel is acting for God, Samuel doesn't agree. And God seems to ask Saul to do something. Well, things that I can't see that. Think of God asking people to do.
I think I have to remember that this is a picture of God drawn from experiences in the ancient world, and their way of being in the world is different from ours. So lots of things, slavery, past just a comment, and we can't abide by that. The role that women typically took in these stories written down by men, we can't abide by that today. And the trick is to try to get underneath the text and behind the culture and find out what the essentials are. And there's not much, you know, these chapters that I race through, there's not much fun there, except for the point out for me that Saul is mistreated here, and that maybe we should reconsider, that should make us look at the text in a different way. It's not a literal narrative of historical truth, but people trying to understand what God was doing and only able to do so in their context.
I guess maybe this is restating what you were saying, but is it the ancient world also struggling with the issue of what is God's power and what does God allow as far as freedom? And is that's sort of what you're saying, as far as rather than make happen directly?
But the picture was more of God making things happen directly.
Yeah, I mean, that was the previous, the way the ancient world saw it, and is part of this sort of that kind of a trying to struggle with the understanding of God and what is the nature of the world.
Yeah. Understanding that if someone got sick, it had to come from somewhere. It didn't just happen. Things didn't just happen. God or gods made everything happen. Everything has some sort of spirit within it. And the Israelites make a big step, apparently, in saying that there's one God. But then that God has to be responsible for everything good that happens, as well as for everything not so good that happens.
One of the things that I remember a presentation on public radio with Elie Wiesel talking about the railing against God that is more a part of the Jewish tradition than it is ours, which fits with this too, saying, God, why is this happening to me? And a kind of a more arguing with God about it. And that sense that everything comes from God would fit with that very, very much. So.
I also heard you suggest that a lot of this seems to have gone through the PR agent of David's reign, which, so I seem to have that. I was also surprised in a couple cases, it looks as if Saul is referring to Samuel's God, as opposed to just saying our God, or my God, it's your God.
Yeah. That may just be a way of talking, but there's some fairly clear evidence that at one point in Israel's history, Yahweh and Elohim or El were really two different gods that were merged together. So that one part of the country would worship Yahweh, and one group within the country was worshiping Yahweh. One group within the country was worshiping El or Elohim. And as they were coalesced into a nation, then they began to talk about Yahweh Elohim. So in some regions you'll have a lot of El names. Beth El, Nathaniel is a personal name, and then you'll alongside Nathaniel, El has given, you'll have Netanyahu, Yahweh has given. And the, not quite a pantheon, but at least their chief deities coalesce into one figure.
Do you think Samuel or Saul felt that Samuel was the link to God?
Oh yeah.
And so God became your God who has given me this power.
Yeah. And he has to see it that way if he's going to believe that he's chosen. You know, Samuel's telling him the truth. If it came to Samuel and not to him, that he was going to be king. He's got to believe that Samuel has a connection with God better than his own. I would see it. Next week, someone other than me will be doing the Bible studies, and I'll be teaching, I think, usually in the 10:30 slot, but I'm going to continue with 1 Samuel. So for those of you who will still be around, I hope I see you. And for those who won't be, it's been fun this week. Have a safe trip.
Thank you. Thank you.